Welcome to the Automate and Grow podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Automate and Grow, and my guest today is Tom Asacker, who's the author of several books, including most recently, I Am Keats. And Tom was actually nominated to be on the Automate and Grow podcast by a previous guest, Virginie from Soho Places, who's business I always get the name wrong with, which is terrible. But so we're really excited to be able to talk to Tom because he writes about different topics, including things like innovation, creativity, and business. And he's got quite the auspicious background. So Tom, I want to thank you for joining the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
No problem. So one of the themes that you talk about is kind of central to what we talk about here, which is innovation and also creativity. And I guess relating to I Am Keats, it seemed to be the inspiration for Virginie in particular to start her business. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you've written about most recently and then maybe about how you got to the point where you were an author and a speaker.
Okay, that'll probably eat up the whole program. The most recent book came because I was working with some organizations and they were talking about the desire to change and they understood the reasons why, but they weren't changing. And it was becoming very frustrating for me trying to understand that process of understanding yet not actually changing your behavior. And I was having breakfast with the business attorney and we were catching up on each other's families. I asked him how his kids were doing. And one of his kids was living at home, 20-something, stuck, he said, just so smart, can't get out of his own way. You can't argue with him about anything. And in my mind, I thought to myself, understanding how human brains work, I knew that it was nothing more than whatever his memories were that had him stuck. Because we make all of our decisions based on what we've stored in memory. That's how it works. We don't make it based on projections that aren't already in our head. So what's in our minds kind of dictates what our future is. And I said to him something like, that's too bad. If we could just wipe his memory clean, we could start him again and get him going on a new path, you know. And he kind of smiled and I left there and I thought about that. And I said, you know, that'd make a great premise for a movie. So I went on this journey to write a screenplay for a movie called I Am Keats.
Oh, okay.
Wrote the screenplay. While I was writing the screenplay, all kinds of philosophies started pouring out of this process, almost as if somebody was speaking to me and my writing partner. And so that's when I wrote this little philosophical book called I Am Keats, which in essence is shows you how to discern these two voices in your head that you have talking to you all the time, this voice of possibility and then this voice of the world that's trying to keep you in some type of box in this story so that you don't get hurt and so that you don't have any problems. And, you know, it's your basic survival instinct, but it's kind of really well hidden. So that's the book that I think that she read, which, you know, the ultimate message I'm trying to get across is that when you wake up in the morning, all you are is pure possibility, unless you're bringing your memories along for the ride. And most people do that, and that's what gets them all caught up. And I can't do that. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm not good enough. It won't work. All of that stuff is just a bunch of made up stories.
So, I mean, one of the themes that we talk about here on, you know, is, you know, we talk to entrepreneurs about their entrepreneurial journey. And I think a lot of people like to listen to that because they maybe aspire to reach a certain level, but they can't get there. And I think you said something and that you're talking about here as well, which is that we have to understand that people are driven by their emotions. They're not like machines or robots.
Right.
And that's kind of the theme you're talking about, which is...
Yeah, look, one of the things that I've learned through, and I've had a lot, some successes, some pretty big successes, and I've had a lot of failures as well. And I've worked with a lot of businesses that have had successes and failures. And one of the things that, if you look through the lens in reverse and say, okay, why didn't these things work? What happened? What was going on in the marketplace? What you'll discover is that if there's not a compelling desire for something in the marketplace, and I don't care what your idea is, it doesn't matter what the idea, because people will say that to me all the time. People, they'll say, this industry needs this.
Whether they know it or not.
Yeah. I mean, they need it. If they don't do it, they're not going to move into the future. And that is the worst thing in the world to do, is to develop some type of product or service based on what you think people need. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't desire it, you'll jam all kinds of money into marketing and sales. You'll never succeed. And what will happen is you'll come back and you'll feel that you did something wrong. And you didn't do a thing wrong. It was simply a timing issue. It was a lack of desire for whatever reason, you know? So
as an entrepreneur, it's almost like what you're saying is that they have to understand the customer from the perspective, like almost empathetically. And there's probably got to be communication there.
Yeah, look, you've got to be the customer. Anytime anybody invites me in to do some advisory work, I don't want them to talk to me at all about what they do, because I don't want to be corrupted at all by any of it. I say, just introduce me to some customers. Let me talk to some of these people. Hmm. And I can tell you after a few days whether or not there's this compelling desire for what they have. And if not, why not? I've worked with inventors, you know, global brands. It doesn't matter if the desire's not there. Because, Michael, we're living in an age of abundance. There is so much stuff now out there, you know, and it has hit the product and service arena years ago. Now it's going to hit the content arena. Now you're going to see everybody that's doing podcasts, blogs, movies, whatever. They're going to start running into the same issue, which is, what is going on? No one's watching our movie. Right? No one's reading my blog. What happened? What happened was, there's an abundance of products and services in the content arena now. So are you giving people what they desire? And that's just how the marketplace works. It's transactional, man.
It's an interesting conundrum, though, for, you know, especially since you talk about creativity, because, you know, you look at great innovators, and it's almost like they understand intuitively what people want, even though they don't want it. So then it goes back to how are you making someone desire something that they haven't had? Because if they want what they already have, then you're just fighting it out on an existing demand curve, and that, you know, leads to lots of competition and little differentiation. So it's kind of a curious conundrum, like, how would I, as an entrepreneur, like, approach this problem?
No, it is. It is.
Without second guessing myself.
No, it's true. No, you're absolutely right. Listen, they don't have to desire all the features of what you have. So in other words, when Steve Jobs released the iPhone, it wasn't like people desired not to have buttons. I mean, that was a big problem, right? It's like, where's the damn buttons?
I was in that industry too. Like, it was like a big debate, right? Like,
where are the buttons?
Right. Because people at that time, the thing that was revolutionary was BlackBerry.
Right.
And then there's this other idea in front of you.
That's
like,
right.
What is this?
That's exactly right. So that's what happens. People, it's interesting. People want what they're used to, but they want something different too. That's the tension that you're dealing with, right? It's people want the known, but they want to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they want a phone with buttons. But wait a minute. This phone can hold 1,000 songs. Hold on. Let me take a look at this thing. So it's really interesting, that tension of how to deal with people's desires in the marketplace. But you need to understand what it is at the core. And that at the core, that phone, the iPhone, was putting all your music on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he discovered when he saw the Nokia phone that had a couple of songs on it, and he stopped production of the iPod and said, okay, here's the future. Go make me a phone with all these songs on it. So he saw that. He saw that. He felt that future, that desire, and that he developed that product with that intuitive feeling for what the customer would want.
I'm blanking on where I saw this, probably even yesterday I saw this, where it was talking about the critical factors of a new startup. And the number one factor, which is probably the hardest to control, is timing. And so what you're talking about is almost like, you know, I don't want to be too bleeding edge, but I can't be too much like everything else. So it's kind of a funny you know, a tactic for an entrepreneur to figure out or attack, like, how do I deal with this? Like, not distrust myself and then find out later I was right or wrong, right? So there's got to be a point where you launch something. you put balloons out into the universe and hope that they float up to the sky, right? So I don't know if you deal with that, because it kind of sounds like you have those competing ideas between the two personalities in your book, I Am Keats.
Yep. Yeah, listen, that is the tension that you're dealing with. I release something to the world without market testing it. When I wrote the book, it just flowed out of me. All right? Now, the good news about that is that I didn't have to rely on other people to make that bet. I could get that book into the world.
You didn't have to ask for permission.
No permission, right? Now, yeah. I have a screenplay in my hand that I want to get made into a movie.
That's different, probably.
Now I need permission. So now what I have to find is I've got to find the people that desire what it is I'm trying to do as well. So I've got to go looking around, spreading this thing around so that somebody picks it up, feels something from it, and says, I like what you're doing. I want to try to work with you to make it happen. So that's, and see, that's the thing about the marketplace. When you toss something out there, like if you're an artist and you toss your work out to the world, well, they may receive it, they may not, right? I mean, Dylan went electric at a folk festival, right? And they try to, you know, the folk guys try to, yeah, they had an axe trying to cut his cord of his electric guitar. So that's the thing about, that's the tension of the marketplace. You're never really going to know until you launch.
So we recently had, there's a quote out there from Jack Ma, and he was at a conference around artificial intelligence, and he was talking about how we educate people, and he said we can't educate them like robots, which kind of goes back to your point that, you know, people are creative and emotion-driven.
Right.
So it sounds like what, you know, you're kind of saying the same thing, which is that we need to clue into this, and we've got a, but, and yet we have got this really, I would say, robotic education system and most public education, which is probably the way most people are educated. So I'm kind of curious, like, what does that set things up for the future? If we're trying to teach people to, and I keep joking about this, but it's like we're educating people for factories that don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we deal with the change that's coming? Because it's like, if we're trying to be robots, that's not going to work, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because if you think about the education system in general, we've tried to educate people by putting information into their heads.
Right. Oh, my
right?
God.
And you don't, that's not how you educate anyone. You educate people through experience, right? That's how you do it. You get them to use something, to learn from it, to personally feel the significance of it. That's how education, true education, works. So what we should be teaching people how to do is how to think, but we're not. We're trying to give them processes, right?
And ideologies, that, maybe, right?
And ideologies,
yeah.
Right?
Where it's exactly. Like this is right and this is wrong, and if you don't think like this, then you're good or bad,
right?
As opposed to being able to critically analyze things you're saying,
right? In other words, how do we get people to just be comfortable with uncertainty, to be able to step into the future and say, I don't know, but this is interesting. Let me see what this means, where it's going to go. Look, most of the innovations that legacy companies should have adopted and taken into the future with the internet, they didn't do it because it felt scary to them, because it was disrupting their own story internally, right? So all the people in there were worried. What will the future hold? Not for the company. What will the future hold for me? If I'm one of the people supporting this thing. And so that's when you saw all of this resistance, and that's why a lot of entrepreneurs who had nothing to lose are the ones who brought these technologies and innovations to the marketplace. Because when you don't have anything, you don't have anything to lose, right?
That goes back to your comment. I think it was probably off camera, but where you're talking about a young person, and it's like, oh, if only we could wipe his mind.
Right.
And start them fresh.
That's it.
So it sounds like, you know, we see companies like Google where they try to bake in an innovation model. So how does a company that's like, before they're on the precipice of destruction, change? or prepare for change.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Here's what prevents people from changing. This is a paradox. Once you develop a story in your mind of who you are, and you've shared that story to the world, this is who I am, and in the business vernacular, we call that a brand, mm-hmm. right? So now you have this strong brand that says, I'm this. And now your people see all kinds of opportunities for how to improve other people's lives, but you can't do it because that's not you, right? I mean, look at Nokia as an example. Somebody once said to me, I said, look, if you see something in the marketplace that you can add value to people's lives, why don't you just do it? And they'll say to me, well, that's not what we do. And I'll say, well, what do you mean it's not what you do? And they'll say, give me an example. I said, well, Nokia made what? And they say cell phones. I said, yeah, but what did they make before that?
Tires.
And they said, yeah.
They still make tires.
Tires. Look, tires, boots.
Trees.
Trees, toilet paper.
Oh, yeah,
right?
That makes sense. There you go.
So imagine somebody saying to Amazon, I see an opportunity. And Jeff Bezos going, look, we sell books. What do you mean we're going to do cloud?
Would be one of the great tragedies of...
Right.
Yeah,
so,
interesting.
So how do you look at the world and say, we have intelligent people, we have capital, how do we bring things to the world? What kind of things? What's the difference?
Right.
How do we do that? Because we need to get an edge, and that's the only way you do it is through innovation. You cannot hold on to your legacy products and services forever. It just doesn't, I've never seen a company do it.
Not for long.
No.
They eventually
No, you can ride that for a while. There's no doubt about it.
So, I mean, I think that's an exciting thing where obviously if you're an entrepreneur, you do have an opportunity to change the world by disrupting things and attacking like someone that's stuck in their ways. And then for a large company, the risk is that, yes, you can keep collecting all this cash, but eventually, I think right now we're seeing it in retail where there's like this seismic change over to e-commerce, which is bizarre. But I guess the question is that if I'm a, let's say I'm in a brand that I'm in retail and I, you know, the reality is, do I become Amazon? Like, how do I survive that? Like, what do I do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now, the reality is that the retail marketplace is probably only 15 to 20% e-commerce. So there's still 80% out there that's brick and mortar or whatever, right? So it's not all e-commerce yet. Now the question is, how do you combine people's desire for a digital experience with what maybe you have in your store? And if you go to these people that run all these stores, and you ask them what they're doing to innovate in the digital sphere, they don't even know how to put up a Facebook page.
Right.
They have their kid doing it on the weekends.
There's no social connection. They're
Nothing.
Still putting stuff on shelves and hoping someone picks it off.
Nothing. Why aren't they not getting you on an email list and introducing you to some new product that they just brought in on Sunday and giving you a preview of it before all the other non-customers? You know, why aren't they doing that?
Right.
Why are people still mailing, you know, putting their little ads in these circulars that come to your mailbox that nobody looks at? Why aren't they creating a personal relationship?
One of the models that's really kind of fascinated me is Supreme. And I don't know if you know much about Supreme, the streetwear brand. And they've been doing collaborations with everyone from Louis Vuitton to... now Rolex to whoever, right? Akira, the anime, and they have almost a scarcity model. So it's kind of interesting. You brought up a couple examples where in retail, they're succeeding not necessarily by being a retailer, but they're a brand, but then they have this like exclusivity, scarcity, excitement. Like you talked about surprise, right?
Right.
So I guess that in a sense, that kind of is analogous to what you're saying, which is, and you see it in the sneaker market, right, where there's kids that are buying sneakers and then flipping them. So it's almost like the learning has to be, how do I understand what the customer wants, give it to them, but not like everything?
No, look, listen, this is simple economics. value in the marketplace is driven by scarcity. It's always going to be like that. And if it's not scarce, people are going to find it somewhere else cheaper, and the price is going to get driven down. And when I say scarce, it could be the experience that's scarce, right? I don't know what it is. You've got to figure out how to weave value into what you do in a complicated way that people just can't knock off. That's a lot of the time people don't think through what a real value proposition is, because it's a lot more than price, location, time, days of operation. There are things in there like identity. What are you doing to build in other people's identity so that they connect with you and connect with other like-minded people? What are you doing on the aesthetic front to make sure that they can see themselves in this environment when they look at it? You know, what kind of control are you giving people? Look, Domino's Pizza blew up, right? Why? Because of a foolish app where you can see the guy driving the car to your house with the pizza.
Right.
Just giving you control that insight, over the experience.
The Uber of pizza.
Yeah. It sounds crazy, but these things are wide open for people to use, these strategies. It's just that it seems that people are moving so quickly, they're afraid to slow down for a minute and say, hey, let's look at our bundle of value and how can we weave more value in and get some help, you know? Let somebody help you, give you some ideas. There are a lot of people out there willing to help.
And I think that goes to another trend that we talk about a little bit. It's like this movement where, you know, they say that in the next, I think it's by 2030, and I've probably quoted this before, where the number of freelance workers is going to exceed the number of employed workers. So it's like when you talk about getting help, I automatically think of this movement towards collectives, which is analogous to almost like creative collectives, but it's, I think that's the way a lot of, you know, business functions are going, like whether it be marketing, sales, almost like these specialists, right? So I don't know what you see. I think there's two aspects of that. One is people that are outsourced because they're pushed out, but I think the best people are going to want to be out there too and capitalize upon their unique skill set, the freedom to do their own thing. How though do I, when if I'm a person that's been working for someone or I've been educated to work for someone, what advice do you have for someone that is suddenly thrust out there and is saying, listen, I'm going to do it on my own, or I have to do it on my own. I don't have other choices. Like, I'm sick of sending out 400 resumes.
Yeah. Look, I hear you. Again, this is interesting because there are really two things going on. You're right. On the one hand, there are a lot of freelancers, right? It's increasingly a bigger size of the pool. But there is also a trend where companies are trying to vertically integrate. You know, where like Amazon saying, "Look, we're just going to do everything," right? And so you'll see people creating their own in-house ad agencies and creative agencies. You're going to see a lot more of that, where they're going to try to get control over their process instead of subbing it out all over the place.
Interesting.
So there's both trends are going on.
Players will kind of consolidate that under their roof, and the smaller guys will kind of work together. And there's probably big mid-size and big guys that will come out of that. But
listen, I cannot think of any organization, industry, company that doesn't need help. Every one of them. There's no one saying to me, we're fine. Everything's going fine. Nobody's worried. There's no anxiety here. Everybody needs some help. So it's up to the freelancers to just get out there and network the hell out of everything that they do to try to make the right connection to the right people that desire what they have. But the opportunity is immense. You know, not only that, look at all the people that are trying to launch because of the barriers to entry have collapsed. Look at all of the entrepreneurs that are creating their own brands.
Right.
Their own, of everything. That's kind of what clothing, you know.
That's what I keep thinking, which is like it's 1,000, you know, or 100,000 or 1,000,000 brands that are going to be launched, right? And that's kind of goes to your, I know you've written in the past on branding, and you know, it's I think you made the point that it's more than a logo. So I don't know what your take on if I'm going out in the world, like how do I brand myself? Like what makes me distinct other than just the way I look?
Yeah. Well, look, it again, it comes down to probably what's driving you. What do you feel? Right. I mean, I had a guy came out of the woodwork years ago to me and he said, look, I've been reading your stuff. Can I talk to you? I said, sure. And we got on a call. And he loves this like river. He loves this river. And I said, well, what's the matter? He says, well, you know, it's getting kind of a little polluted. And what I'd like to do is I want to create this product where X amount percentage of the profits goes to cleaning up to the preserving this river and all of this. And I said, well, then do it. Go make your product. Discover where the retailers are. Create an online presence. Go to the river where everybody camps out and hand out your little pamphlet, your cards. I said, just if you feel that passionate about something, there are other people that feel the same way. And if you can get them something of value, they will support you with their business. See, the problem with most charitable organizations is that they don't want to provide value. They just want you to give.
It's guilt.
Right.
Help me.
Right.
Please.
Help me. Please help me. But look, at there are so many ways to provide value through a transaction. Do it that way.
Interesting.
That's what the Girl Scouts do.
So that's a really – yeah, that's right. Everybody wants Girl Scout cookies, right, to your point.
Yeah, well, even if you're getting something so you feel like there was a – you know, some kind of transaction. That's how the marketplace works.
But and I think that goes back to your point. There's a limit – you know, if you use the example of nonprofits, there's a limit to altruism. There has to be a whiffum, right? What's in it for me?
Absolutely.
And that goes back to your emotional connection, which is understand that people are driven by emotions. So if I'm branding myself, I think the message that I'm taking away from what you're saying that is critical for people is understand your why, like understand the reason why, not just what you do and how you do it, but why you're doing it, and then communicate that. Get that idea out there to connect.
Well, bring it to life. That's the difference, because a lot of people think if they communicate their why, that somehow things will just start happening. And it doesn't work like that. Because if I ask people, and I've done it as an experiment, if I ask people that bought something recently, like a car, mm-hmm. shoes, they went to a restaurant, right? Whatever it is. If I say to them, what's that company's why? They'll look at me like I got a couple of heads. They'll say, what are you talking about? I say, well, you just bought that car. You just bought that.
What was the story that you connected with,
though? Yeah, what's the why behind that? Yeah. They said, look, what do you mean the why? It's a great looking car. It gets good gas mileage. I got this financing. So you've got to bring your why to life for them,
mm-hmm.
and tap into their desires. And then you've got the connection that you're looking for. You can't just say, help me because I make the best stuff in the world.
Right.
It doesn't work.
That makes a lot of sense. So the takeaway, I think, again, is make sure that you're not only telling your story, but finding that motivates not just you, but other people that want to be your customer, essentially. Whether you're
exactly.
a boutique agency or a little SaaS shop or mom and pop shop or a big, big brand, it sounds like that's consistent.
Yeah. What is the desire of your audience when they interact with you, transact with you? What is the feeling that they're getting back? Is the feeling I'm smart? Is the feeling I'm a good guy? Is the feeling I love the environment? What is the feeling that they're getting back? And how are you giving them that feeling?
That's the customer experience, right, that you're talking about in a sense.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, if you want to know what a brand is, that's what a brand is. It's the customer experience. It's not the logo, the tagline. That's another thing you can go ask a lot of people. Say, hey, did you just buy that? Yeah, what's their tagline? They'll say, I don't have any idea what the tagline is.
They're trying 100 of them.
Yeah, who
what's
cares?
The gap? What is the gap one? Is it fall into the gap?
I don't know. What's Toyota's? It moves? We move? I don't even know.
Any.
Does Google have a tagline? I don't think so.
Do no evil? I don't know.
I don't know.
I think that's kind of their theme.
Like a mission or something?
Yeah, sort of, right? Yes. Well, Tom, I really appreciate your insight, and I think it's really helpful for both larger organizations and smaller organizations when they're thinking about, because I just believe the next 10 years are going to be super disruptive, and that creates huge opportunity, but there's also threats with that because just the pace of change. So I think it's super helpful for people to understand different perspectives, and I think you hit a few things really important on the head. I want to be conscious of your time, so I'll wrap up with three things, which will probably take more than a couple minutes. But
it's okay.
The one question that I ask people is, how are you, Tom, changing the world?
How am I changing the world? Well, look, anytime I interact with anyone, I'm trying to give them some energy, some insight. So if they take that and do something with it, that's my way of changing the world. I try to do that through my writing and through all my experiences that I have with people. I want people to know that everything that we do in life as human beings is all made up. It's all invented. People are, it is, and people are telling stories, you know, success stories. They're not telling you about how lucky they were. So I just want people to realize that they can go create anything that they want to create. There's nobody stopping them.
There's people that are trying to stop people, though, with bad ideas, right?
Well, look, if whoever is more focused on the audience that they're working with and whoever is more creative in how they bring value to the world, those are the people that are going to win long term. There's no way to stop that because there's, like I said, there's no barrier, you know, other than some of these, you know, governmental barriers that still exist and some technology barriers that still exist. But those are going to collapse too. You know it as well as I do.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I forgot to mention was that I know you've done a TEDx. I'm just curious what the theme of that was and what that experience was like.
Yeah. You want to laugh? I got a call because someone was reading my stuff, and his significant other was the coordinator for one of the biggest TEDx's, which is TEDx Cambridge down in Boston.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And she got on the phone with me and she said, I heard about you and I think it'd be great if you could come down and give a talk. And I said, nah, I don't think I want to go do that. And I'm serious. And it stunned her. And she was stunned because everybody
like what do you mean? Everybody wants to do a TEDx.
Yeah. And I didn't. I said, nah, I don't want to do that. And she said, what do you mean you don't want to do it? And I said, well, I don't think these TED Talks do anything. I think it's just entertainment. I don't think they do anything to change anybody's behavior at all. And there was a long pause and she said, why don't you come down and give a talk about why TED Talks don't change people's behaviors?
There you go.
And that's what I said. I said, you'll let me do that? She goes, yes. I said, okay, you're on. I'll do it. So that's what that TED Talk is about.
Okay, I got to watch that for sure then. I think I started to, and I meant to watch the rest of it.
Well, look, that is what my philosophies about how the marketplace work and how people's behaviors do change are all weaved into that 17-minute talk.
Okay, great. Okay, we're going to – I'll post that up in the show notes. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you? Is it through your website, or what would you like people to check out?
Yeah, or they can go to my last business book that really explains this. It's called The Business of Belief.
Okay.
So if they go to thebusinessofbelief.com, they'll land on that page and they'll be inside of my site and they'll see all the other things I'm doing too. So.
Terrific. Tom, I want to thank you for joining us. I'm going to wrap up with one final thing, which is, and I might have given you a little bit of a preview of this because you were nominated to be on the show. And when we have interesting guests, I always ask you to nominate someone else that you might fit with the themes that we talk about. So I'd like you, and usually it's the first person that comes to your mind, to nominate someone to appear as a guest that you can introduce us to.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you reach out to Jonathan Salem Baskin. And he's a... This guy has a pedigree of experience. He's in the innovation sphere. He's a brilliant writer. And see if you can get him on. You'd really enjoy him. He's got some real insights.
Terrific. And you can introduce us to him, you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. That's great. Well, Tom, I really appreciate your insight into everything on creativity and innovation and change in particular. I appreciate you being on this episode. I think this is episode 16 that we've recorded.
All right.
So you're
congratulations.
Thank you. It's going quickly. And we're meeting lots of interesting people like yourself. So this has been another episode of Automate and Grow. And I will see everybody on another episode. And we have a nomination that we'll follow up with Tom on to get the new guest on.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
This has been an episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. Check out other episodes for interesting topics on how to grow, innovate, and automate your business. Subscribe or like us on iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, or on our website at www.automategrow.biz and get your copy of the book Automate and Grow at Amazon today.